Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the very first day of January 2018. It's New Year's Day. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Scott Irwin. He's an agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I and has a contrarian view of price moving forward. We'll also take a look at the value of farmland and why it may very well continue to hold up as we move through 2018 and beyond. Bruce Sherrick will be here. Actually, we've got excerpts from a conversation with Bruce Sherrick that was held during the Farm Assets Conference in the month of November, and we'll do all of that on this New Year's Day edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media, Public Radio for the Farming World.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Our term of the day is margin. The initial margin requirement is the amount of money required to be collateralized in order to take a position in the marketplace. Thereafter, the amount required to be kept in collateral until the position is closed is the maintenance requirement. The maintenance requirement is the minimum amount to be collateralized in order to keep an open position. Now, it's generally lower than the initial requirement. This allows the price to move against the margin without forcing a margin call immediately after the initial transaction. Margin call, when the margin posted in the margin account is below the minimum margin requirement, the broker or exchange issues a margin call. The investors now either have to increase the margin, the amount of money they have deposited, or close out their position. They can do this by selling the securities, options, or futures if they are long and buying them back if they are short. But if they do none of these, then the broker can sell their securities to meet the margin call. If a margin call occurs unexpectedly, it can cause a domino effect of selling, which will lead to other margin calls, and so forth, effectively crashing an asset class or a group of asset classes. This situation most frequently happens as a result of an adverse change to the market value of the leveraged asset or contract. It could also happen when the margin requirement is raised, either due to increased volatility or due to legislation. In extreme cases, certain securities may cease to qualify for margin trading. In such a case, the brokerage will require the trader to either fully fund their position or to liquidate it. And that is the definition of margin. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online. Listen to us on demand anytime you would like. The address is willag.org. Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklovic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the Closing Market Report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalo. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the Closing Market Report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. This is the Closing Market Report. It's New Year's Day. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. If you're a producer, you know you've been battling low prices for the last 4 years. And looking forward, with the size of the carryouts for both the corn and soybeans, even the wheat, things don't look to be getting any better anytime soon. There is a contrarian in the AgEcon ranks here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. That's Scott Irwin. He now joins us to talk a little bit about that. Hey, Scott, thanks for being with us. Why do you think prices might go higher over the longer term?
To some degree, I suspect that people would be disappointed, even though I have a contrarian view on the long-run movement of grain prices. It's not something that's easy to get rich doing, as almost anybody who's been in the grain markets would know.
The work you and Daryl Good, Scott, have done suggests there are long-run price eras. Can you tell me about them and why they happen?
Well, the answer to the first part is easy. The second part, not so much. The periods that I call eras of grain prices run from post-World War II to 1973, and then from 73 to 2006, and 2006 to the present. And what we have found to date is that grain prices, unadjusted for inflation, tend to move in a range during these eras. And if you're at high prices in the range, you'll tend to revert back to the average. And if you're at low prices, you'll tend to slowly at some point crawl back up towards the average. And that seems to be the pattern. Now, why do we apparently move in such reasonably defined ranges over so many decades until there's a big jump in the average price? No real good answers for that. My own personal view is it just reflects a relatively stable supply and demand dynamics. You're talking about generally food commodity markets. They don't change that rapidly. Who's producing them? Who's consuming them? So as long as economic growth is not, wildly high or low, we'll tend to bounce around in a range.
Can you describe the current era and when you think it began and what the price looks like?
We don't have the benefit of 30 or 35 years of hindsight like we, had looking back from 73 to 2006. But it's pretty clear that a new era started in 2006 and we saw a major jump in the average price level. To date, here in Illinois, corn prices, for example, have averaged about $4.50 since 2006. Now, of course, the last 4 years, prices have been much lower on average, probably something like $3.50. I'm not sure exactly what that average would be for the last 4 years in Illinois, but that'd probably be pretty close. And prices have ranged from roughly $3 to $8 a bushel. And that's our current situation. And the big argument is, should we look at prices going forward, say the next 5 years? They're low now, and should we therefore forecast a continuation of prices in the low $3 range? Or should we believe that corn and soybean prices are mean reverting and they'll revert back up towards some higher average price than say $3 to $3.50? And so that's where the debate really is occurring.
What's the answer to that then? Should farmers be less aggressive marketing at these prices?
Well, it all depends on your belief. If you believe conventional wisdom, you should prepare and project low $3, sub $3.50 corn prices, basically as far as the eye can see. That is not my view. I will be the first to admit that prices have gone lower longer than I expected when we came off the highs, but I still believe that a projection of an average price for the next 5 years closer to $4 than $3.25 or $3.50 is more realistic.
So am I correct that weather, as related to supply, doesn't really play a role in the long-term era pricing, but that it's demand-driven?
And so what happened in 2006 is pretty obvious. It's ethanol, and we've also had some continued support from China on the soybean side. But this was primarily a jump inspired by ethanol in the RFS. And so what this fundamentally means to me in terms of thinking about marketing strategies is I believe that corn and soybean prices do revert to a long-run average until another era forms. And that means when we're at low prices, like we are now, I expect that we will eventually revert back up to the mean. So that's the good news. The bad news is I don't have much confidence in my ability to exactly time when that's going to occur. That will require prediction, especially of weather problems. But it does have a very practical implication, which is I don't want to be very aggressive in forward selling my crops at these price levels. We don't have much choice, really, but to market them, the current crops, with the prices that are existing. But I'm willing to bet, year after year for a while, that I just don't want to be locked in to a situation when corn prices, actually go up back up above, say, $5 a bushel, and then I've sold at $3.80. I don't want to lock myself into that situation because I think we're going to get those better pricing opportunities eventually. That's what history teaches us.
So given all that, Scott, what's your prediction for prices over the next, say, 5 years and the impact on land prices?
Excellent question. For corn, I would use a U.S. average price of $4. For soybeans, $10.75. And for all wheat, $4.75. Something in around those levels is where I think we will end up averaging. Land prices are really interesting. It appears that the people at the margin that are bidding on and determining land value believe my contrarian position on prices. That's at least one way to reconcile the firmness of land values, is that these long-run investors, whether they be farmers or outside investors, are counting on some reversion to averages like that that will restore profitability.
Finally, then, if prices are down at the bottom of the trading range, what then will it take to move prices higher?
Well, I think it will be two things. One that will be slow and one that will be a little bit more violent. The slow factor will be a return to better rates of economic growth around the world and in the U.S. that will largely feed through livestock demand into feed grain and oilseed prices. But the big one, in my opinion, will be a return to a more normal frequency of bad weather in the United States. That makes me sound really doom and gloom, but we've just come off of the best 20 plus year period since 1895 in terms of U.S. Corn Belt weather. And over the next 5-10 years, history says that you wouldn't want to project that we would have such good weather again. And I think it'll be a series in a fairly short period of time of some really poor weather. That'll be the big event that pulls us out.
Scott Irwin is an agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Well, you're listening to the Closing Market Report on this New Year's Day. Now let's take a look at the value of farmland with Bruce Sherrick, agricultural economist. He spoke during the November 22nd Farm Assets Conference held in Bloomington Normal. Here's an excerpt of his speech.
Okay, now I'm going to spend more time on this than you might guess. I'm going to talk about farmland values to try to make what I think is a really impressive case for why farmland values have held up better than many people thought. I always ask this question in the class we teach in the spring to students. There will be a Federal Open Market Committee meeting the next day. We'll know whether they're going to raise rates or not. What's going to happen? They'll say, well, they are going to raise rates. And you say, who are they? And what rates did they raise? And here's why this is so critical. The 10-year Treasury actually declined the day after the very first rate increase and the day after the third rate increase. And rates have hovered sub 2.5. And this is a big part of the story about farmland. Now, you may not think this is the farmland story, but it turns out to be. Does the farmland market make sense? And Gary and I both use this slide or some version of this a lot. I put up three states, Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa. Illinois blue, Indiana red, Iowa black in each of the graphs to try to give us a mental reference to the schools. And then the 10-year treasury is this green line above. Now, I look at this and I say, when was there a fundamental departure between what I could earn in a risk-free position and what I could earn long-term in agriculture? And the only great deviation was in the 80s. And there was some kind of lender participation that fueled that crisis, frankly. That the nature of lending has changed dramatically since then. My personal view is it's not a bad time to restructure your balance sheet and put fixed rate. I saw the farmer rack rate sheets this morning. Long-term fixed rate debt sub 4% doesn't seem like a bad bet to me. We can look at this and say, well, that's been declining though, and declining cap rate means you pay more for a future dollar of income. If I ask you the following, how much would you pay me today if I were to deliver $1 to you each year from now on forever? A dollar every year just shows up and it's permanent and it's guaranteed by the government or something even safer than the government. It's guaranteed by, safer than the government. What would that be? It's guaranteed by China. For the next million years, you're gonna get $1. What would you pay for that right today? And you'd say, well, what's my cost of borrowing against that? Do the calculation and say, for instance, if there's a 5% interest rate, I'll pay $20 for that because I could deposit $20 at 5% and generate $1 a year forever. Well, I think about farmland markets to some degree like that. So the two complicated questions are, what income is it going to generate in the future? That's one. And what does it cost me to buy that income? What's my cost of capital? That's number two. Now, as farm operators, I never thought that way. I didn't think that way growing up. I didn't think that way while I was still farming. I just didn't. But in fact, I did, because I had to make decisions about everything else I bought and sold, which implicitly balanced that argument. That's what solved that equation. So those are those, and then here's the analog, and this is where I probably should actually end, except I have a bunch more time now. Illinois farmland market is the blue line, the actual values. The dotted line is what we would predict the values to be if we didn't know anything else. We didn't know what values were. All we could do is measure the incomes and measure our cap rates. And this is something a lot of people, I think, miss in the arguments that when income went down, that farmland values were supposedly going to drop. For the last 6 years or so, I keep being kind of the counterpoint to these conferences. Fed had a conference called Don't Bet the Farm. A Nobel Prize winner said the next bubble, dark horse, will be farmland. There have been numerous conferences about the impending crash in farmland. And I keep going up and being the guy who says, the sky isn't falling, it's pretty boring, markets are rational, let's look at this. Here's how I want to look at it. If we take the actual value, that's the solid lines, so Iowa went up higher than Illinois, Indiana did not climb as much, and Illinois stayed in the middle. For the last 3 years, we've been on a bit of a decline, and then through 17, actually, if you just look at reported auctions, and those show up faster than we get all transfers from the Department of Revenue, but it looks like we're back up reasonably strong at the end of the year, actually. But again, I'll wait till all the data come in for this. But if we said agnostically, let's just look at, you know, hand this to a financial engineer, what would they be willing to pay for this asset? Well, if you take the income forecast and divide it by the cap rate, you get these predicted values. And what happened was farmers are very rational. Farmers still buy a little more than 80% of the farmland that sells. Okay? Non-investor farmers, and investors have a whole taxonomy as well, whether it's institutional or fiduciary now. But farmers are still the majority of buyers. They didn't say all the income we had from 2006 through 12 and 13, depending where you were either really great years or just not bad years. They didn't think that was permanent. So land values didn't go up as much as that argument would have suggested they should. Now, you have to make the rationalization going forward. These two lines eventually will get back together. They're on the wrong side to be a bubble, frankly. But they have to eventually get back together. So does that mean cap rates are going to go up? It's probably a reasonable argument that in the long run, as productivity returns in the US, productivity is actually returning, we're going to eliminate some of the extra capital at the short end of the yield curve. Cap rates are probably going to go up. At least they're probably not going down further. I'm going to make that argument. And long-term income in agriculture, if it goes up, or if cap rates go up, then these converge. So both those two scenarios at least don't look like the farmland has a lot further to drop. Now, economists, you know, always have two hands on the other hand, and 50% of the time I'm wrong is my goal. You know, those kind of issues mean that this is a hard thing to forecast. Much like Eric said, the weather next year is going to be hard to forecast. Lots of other things can happen. We can have a supply shock and prices can go up. We can have a great big slowdown in the world's consumption of calories, and that can actually push the other way. There's lots of things that can go wrong, but just agnostically at the date we're at today, learning what long-term income looks like and learning what long-term cost of owning land is on a cap rate analog, those are the two big plays. Okay, a couple of things. Farmland still holding values. Remember, the other way you can say that is values. I'm still holding farmland. A lot of people really want to own farmland. And I'm going to run out of time here, but I want to talk really quickly about a couple of things. Iowa's bounced back. The ABA conference last week, a couple of really remarkable sales were noted, and these weren't sort of off-market in the sense that it was just two crazy neighbors bidding for the 1 acre between. These were real-scale, real-at-scale farms that sold at pretty high prices. A lot of people are saying a little bit of, you know, extra growth this year in income from the high, and fund institutional interest is actually helping to establish a floor, even if they don't buy anything. This is just something neat to see. Over the long term, if you held farmland from 70 on, you're really, really happy because it's had a high rate of return, a low risk, and then this is organized with land at the top, equities, fixed income, and inflation-sensitive assets at the bottom. So negative correlation with financials, positive correlation with inflation, near zero with fixed income. But I'm cheating. 70 on the golden years. Let's go to 80. Well, negative with financials, positive with inflation, around zero with fixed income. What about the 90s? Negative, positive, a little bit more positive with fixed income. Ag is being viewed in the financial markets as an increasingly safe asset, frankly. So the final thing, improved efficiency will always capture economic rents. Last thought I'll leave you with. Whenever you look in an economic textbook, undergrad, grad school, popular, one of the very first stories is always Ricardo's theory of rent. All of the good examples are agricultural. The most fixed factor of production always captures the economic rent. Land will always capture the economic rents from the agricultural production system. Produce food, the excess value of the cost of the input you put in versus the things you take out, accrue at least largely to the owner of the most fixed factor of production, and that's the land. That's been true for 200 years. I predict it'll be true for 200 more years. So that's the only long-range forecast I'll make, is that Ricardo will still be right in the future. Thank you.
Those were excerpts of the comments that Bruce Sherrick made about the value of farmland at the Farm Assets Conference in the month of November in Bloomington Normal. Of course, you're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Do find us online at willag.org.
It's Oatmeal Day. It's also St. Basil's Day. On this day in agricultural history in 45 BC, New Year's Day was celebrated for the first time on January 1st, when the Julian calendar took effect. In 1859, Michael Owens was born. An American manufacturer, he invented the automatic glass bottle-making machine that revolutionized the industry and eliminated child labor from glass bottle factories. In 1863, Daniel Freeman became the first person to submit a claim under the new Homestead Act for 160 acres near Beatrice, Nebraska. In 1898, Post grape nuts were introduced to the public by C.W. Post of Battle Creek, Michigan. In 1936, the Herald Tribune of New York began microfilming its current issues from that date, becoming the first U.S. newspaper to make a current record of its publication. In 1994, the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And in 2002, the euro was introduced, the new monetary unit of the European Union. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock. At the tone, Eastern Standard Time. 11 hours, 12 minutes, 25 seconds. Universal Time.
This is the official voice of time in the United States. It is the U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock Announcer, a voice many radio and television stations depend upon. Well, the U.S. Naval Observatory's written mission includes determining the positions and motions of the Earth, Sun, Moon, planets, stars, and, well, other celestial objects, providing astronomical data determining precise time, measuring the Earth's rotation, and maintaining the master clock for the United States. The U.S. works off the Gregorian, or Christian, calendar, and our concept of a year, of time, is based on the Earth's motion around the sun. The time from one fixed point, such as the solstice or the equinox, to the next, is called a tropical year. Its length is about 365 days, but varies by a few minutes or hours. Our concept of a month is based on the moon's motion around the Earth, although this connection has been broken in the calendar we now use. The time from one new moon to the next is about 29 and a half days, so the moon cycles and our monthly Christian calendar don't quite coincide. It has years of 365 or 366 days, is divided into 12 months that have no relationship to the motion of the moon, and groups weeks in sets of 7 days. But today, a website called Calendars Through the Ages reports almost everyone takes the precision of our calendars for granted, unaware of the long threads spooling out from our clocks and watches backward in time, running through virtually every major revolution in human science. The thread, it says, runs largely through the West, since this is a source of the world's civic calendar, but also casts lines of varying sizes and thicknesses outward to China, India, Egypt, Arabia, and Mesopotamia. Unwinding backward, it pauses at Clavius and Bacon, at the rush of knowledge coming from Islam in the East during the Middle Ages, at bloody wars fought over dates after Rome's collapse, and at Rome itself, at its height, when Julius Caesar fell in love with Cleopatra, an affair that gave the West its calendar. Many different calendars have been developed over the millennia to help people organize their lives. According to a recent estimate, there are about 40 calendars used in the world today, particularly for determining religious dates. Most modern countries use the Gregorian or Christian calendar for their official activities. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
At the tone, Eastern Standard Time, 11 hours, 13 minutes, 10 seconds.
You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. Wishing you the very best in the new year. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.